Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today, I have another extraordinary biologist who has been so inspirational, not just for his amazing theory, but for how it's opened my eyes to the broader cultural issues about paradigm changes in science and kind of how slowly the wheels turn sometimes. So today, we are talking to Dr. Philip Bell, the originator of the viral eukaryogenesis theory. So, if you're just a humble potato farmer out there, this might all be a little bit much for you, but we'll try and do our best to kind of fill you in. And if you're starting with like a high school level of biology, I'll do my best to kind of bridge the gap. So, viral eukaryogenesis is the theory that complex cells, like you and I have, which have a large complex nucleus, that nucleus originally derived from a viral species that moved into a bacterial ancestor and basically decided that it liked the place and it was going to do it up and evolve it into all of the complex life that we see around us today. So, with that brief introduction out of the way, Philip, do you want to tell us a bit more about who you are and how you found your way into this very different, some would say fringe theory. I would argue against that. I think it's going to be mainstream given enough time. So yeah, tell us a bit about you and let's kick this off.
Okay, I hope it will move from the fringes to the mainstream eventually, but I'm not particularly thinking that's going to happen quickly. As a bit of background, I'm currently about 63. I did a lot of different things in my past. I wasn't one of the classic, I'm going to go to school, go straight to university. I did, but I did a geology degree, and then after geology, I decided I don't want to live in the remote part of Queensland where I was working. So I went back to uni in my 20s, and eventually did honours in biochemistry and genetics, and then worked. I've always wanted to do both things that are interesting, but also practical as well. So I went and decided I'd go and work for industry. After 4 or 5 years there, I started a PhD. So at the ripe young age of about 40, I finished my PhD, and of course, the academic career is a little bit over by then. You can't just step into a job very easily. You don't have the career path. So I eventually ended up starting my own business, working on yeast genetics. I worked for a yeast company, and then got retrenched. You know, the usual things that happen to scientists. You don't get this clear path of necessarily straightforward degree. And then we started the company, and then in the meantime, I'd actually as far back as about 1994, I actually came up with this. I've always been interested in the origin of life, and I just thought, hey, I wonder whether life, our complex life forms, could have viruses involved in it. And so, from that period, then I probably did research for another 10 years. Before I got it to the state at the theory, and I thought, you know, there's something to this theory. And then it took me quite a bit longer. So it was about 2000, I published the first paper on it. So you're talking at least 6 years of research. The reason it took partly so long is because, are you allowed to publish papers if you're just not an academic? And I actually discovered, yes, you can. You can just go and write a paper, submit it to a journal, and if they like it and send it out to peer review, they will publish if it's good enough. So that's where I started, and basically I coined the term viral eukaryogenesis because it's nice to have a name for a theory, and that was actually very beneficial over time. And so I've been working in my spare time and some of my work time on developing this theory, and basically I'm very pleasantly surprised by the amount of information that has actually come out in support of my theory over the last 25 years. And it's these 25 years virtually since I published the original paper. Is
So,
that
do you want to quickly go over like the features of the modern cell nucleus that are a big hint that are consistent with it possibly having a viral origin?
Look, the most important feature of the eukaryote nucleus that made me believe this theory and thought it was worth pursuing, is a complicated one. It's the way that a nucleus exports the RNA from the nucleus into the cytoplasm for translation. And there's a gene there that's very important It caps the mRNA, so in other words, puts a little tag on the front of that RNA that makes it nice and stable, and then makes it so that it gets translated in the cytoplasm. And the strange thing is that it was what really made me start thinking about the virus was it was only found in eukaryotes and some viruses. And this is a particular class of virus. I went and looked through every type of virus at the time, and I eventually found that the pox viruses were the only ones that actually were known to produce this enzyme. And it was clearly quite different. And so from there, I thought, well, I can see why a virus would want to do it, and eukaryotes would want to do it. So that was basically the starting point. And then it's basically researching, researching, researching. And of course, science moves on. Now, I would argue that it's hard to explain, but basically, eukaryotes have this nucleus where all its DNA is located, but it only translates or makes proteins in the cytoplasm. That is not like how bacteria work. And you've got to ask a question, how do you do that? Just increment. So the current models for evolution are that everything evolves incrementally. You gradually change, you gradually change. But this is such a step change, it's really hard to see how to do it because you can't have a half a nucleus that's functional. And so the benefit of my theory is that basically it brings in a nucleus as in a single event, much like the mitochondria came in as a single event. So that's basically the reason that started it back in 1994. But there's a ton of evidence now, I believe.
You were also very lucky in a way that the giant mimiviruses were discovered. I think it was just a year or two after your first paper.
Yeah, well, they were discovered in 2004. And up until then, everyone thought the viruses were very, very small. And this is an interesting thing about paradigms. The reason everyone thought the viruses were small is because to isolate a virus, you're supposed to run your sample through a filter, which will filter out all the cells. And what's left are the viruses. And so everyone just kept looking for small viruses because they filtered out all the giant viruses. And then somebody accidentally discovered a giant virus. And that giant virus, it turns out, is related to the pox viruses and therefore related to my theory. This giant virus is an example of a relative of the eukaryote nucleus, as far as my theory would go.
And I think it's one of the difficulties is that viral evolution is so dynamic that I think the skeptics are looking for like basically a direct precursor of some kind of modern eukaryotic nucleus just floating around in viral form to be incontrovertible. But the chance of that kind of strain persisting for what, 2 billion years
Yeah,
in a
well,
recognizable form is a bit of a stretch.
yes and no. I sadly think that actually the viral relatives of the nucleus will still be out there infecting the ancestor of the eukaryote cell. So I believe that there's some evidence for that. I won't go into the details of it, but giant viruses have been found to infect bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotes. There are lots of giant viruses being discovered that infect the archaea. I would predict that one of those viruses will be a relative of the eukaryote nucleus. And I make that clear in several of my papers that I predict that a giant virus like this will exist.
Well, I mean, it's a very cool story because those archaeal ancestors have been putatively identified in deep sea thermal vents, the Loki Archaeota, I think they're called.
Yep, Loki archaeota.
And they're not the easiest things to sample. Like, you need a submarine and
Yeah,
all
and look,
sorts
and
of.
the problem with them is they're extraordinarily slow growing as well. So there was a Japanese group who actually got into culture. So they were actually discovered via metagenomic sequences, which means people just sequenced dirt from the bottom of the ocean and assembled the genomes out of that. And they went, hey, look, there's this archaea that looks like the ancestor of the eukaryotes or an ancestor of the eukaryotes. And it took another 5 years or so for this Japanese group to actually culture one. And it took them many years to get into culture. There was a fantastic bit of work by them. And it's just a classic prokaryotic archaeal organ.
And then more recently, I think there's been some viral environmental surveys from those habitats that have
Yeah, they
found
did. Yes.
bits and
Yes, they did.
pieces of things, but it's probably still early days on that front.
Well, it's interesting that the so the story is basically that the sediments which they found the archaea in, they also got a lot of other sequences of other things. And there was this big debate in the literature between two groups, the people who did the discovery, that's T. Sesmith's group, and the Patrick Forterra group, who were arguing that no, this is all artifacts, etc. And eventually, T. Sesmith's group was shown to be, very good quality work, because the genome that they assembled was very similar to the one that was cultured. But what's super interesting for me, and people don't seem to see the problem with it, is that when they looked at those sediments, they confirmed that there are no eukaryotes in there. Yet they found lots of eukaryotic viruses. And of course, they have to come up with ad hoc explanations for that. They have to say, well, it fell out of the water column into there, or they're not sure how it could possibly be there. But my theory would suggest that those viruses not only are relatives of the viruses that infected the ancestor of the eukaryotes. Sorry, probably not. Complicated.
No, I've got it. I've got it. I've got it. That's really interesting too, because it suggests when that critical combination of archaea, bacteria for the mitochondria, and the virus all locked together, would they have had to pretty rapidly move out of that very unusual ecosystem if it's too extreme for modern eukaryotes?
Well, remember when the first ones appeared, there are no eukaryotes. This is the leading to the first eukaryote. It's those bacteria, those archaea, are very well adapted to that particular environment. It's an aspect of the model that I'm actually actively researching at the moment, is how to explain that there is so much innovation in a eukaryote genome. It is so different to a bacteria, and it's so different to an archaea, and it's actually quite different to the virus as well. So there was a huge amount of genetic innovation that occurred in that step. So when it got the emergent superorganism that I talk about in those papers, the virus and the archaea, the virus infecting the archaea and enslaving the bacteria, there's still a lot more which I don't understand how to explain in there as well. But that's what I'm actively researching at the moment.
It kind of reminds me, because my thing is hybridization and speciation, that there's evidence during a hybridization event there it triggers a kind of cascade of genome re or rescrambling, reorganization. Like it's like, I don't know, I'm trying to give a good analogy. It's like the great vowel shift with
Yeah.
English, that everything, all the networks that are intertangled with each other kind of
Well, now
push on each other.
you've got two or three networks working together, giving you emergent complexity, and basically the whole, it's a novel form of life, and it takes a long time to find its equilibrium, because there's a long time. So I would argue that there's a long period of time between the infection of the archaea and the capture of the mitochondria. There's a long time between that and the emergence of the first eukaryote, potentially, hundreds of millions of years, while all the genes from the archaea were added to the viral genome, the bacterial, the same thing. So that's probably going to have happened over a very long period of time. And so the reorganization of the genome is something you would definitely expect.
And there's really profound differences in scale and metabolic intensity in eukaryotic cells versus a typical bacterial one. They're much bigger, and they often have like the rate at which they turn over energy is often much higher. I think you had some theories about that in some of your papers. Did you want to elaborate?
On the, well, not so much on the energy transfer.
I guess that's more related to the mitochondria, that they
Yeah, the
became
mitochondria. Look, I mean,
specialized and
every,
proliferated.
yeah, I mean, everyone today, if you go and look at your biology textbook 101, it'll go, the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. And that is entirely true. It generates all the ATP. But it, and although, a lot of, what's interesting is that a lot of people think of the mitochondria these days, because they're taught that it's an endosymbiont, they think of it as kind of like a bacteria living in the cytoplasm of the host, but it's actually nothing like a bacteria in a lot of ways. It's only our mitochondria only has 13 genes. Typical bacteria has 3,000. So, it's actually just like the way I put it, it's the chassis is left of the thing. It's like a Volkswagen and a Porsche. They might have the same chassis, but the nucleus is the one that determines whether you're getting a Volkswagen or a Porsche. It's the mitochondria is not a bacteria anymore. It's the product of a very long enslavement, and it's really just an organelle now.
I mean, it's a very dynamic organelle. Like the rate, particularly in the brain, at which the rate at which mitochondria are shuffled between cells, and the amount of electrical activity they're involved in is really mysterious as well. Apart from all the involvement in cell cycle regulation and apoptosis and sensing, like they've got so many other things that they're doing. But I don't know, they seem to do it through more just numbers. Like they're so abundant. In a typical eukaryotic cell, even if they're individually simple, they have all sorts of collective behaviors which go beyond just producing ATP.
Yeah, look, this is what makes me still super fascinated by life, is that basically an evolution is that if you're an evolutionist like I am, that somehow us being self-aware evolved from something much, much more simple. And it is super interesting to just look at the number of ways that that had to happen. I mean, it's absolutely spectacularly interesting that, it has been able to achieve what we, self-aware humans today. It's just incredible.
Now, if there was this one key viral endosymbiosis that kind of kicked off the whole eukaryote experiment, are there any possible other examples of like other viruses doing a similar thing? Because I mean, like bacteria have done it multiple times. Are there minor viruses that have contributed to specific lineages? And I'm guessing you'd probably look to the protists because they're such a grab bag of weirdos. There's got to be something lurking in there.
Look, there is heaps. There's a lot. I mean, the one I like to do, I wrote in one of my papers, because one of the things I'm looking for is other things. So you were mentioning the mitochondria, for example. All the transcription occurs in the mitochondria using a nuclear encoded RNA polymerase. But that's a phage RNA polymerase. So there's one example. But if you listen to this podcast and you remember it, just think, actually, this memory that I created to listen to this is actually done via a virus. So it turns out that the way our synapses work, they actually send these little RNA vesicles between the synapses to generate long-term memory. Those RNA-containing vesicles are RNA-containing vesicles just like a virus, but they actually have the protein cage that it's in is actually homologous to HIV virus. So it's a retrovirus that's been exapted for our use to actually do memory in mammals and animals.
I guess with like subsequent viruses, it's much easier for that eukaryotic system to just pick and choose parts of them that are useful rather than taking them on as a whole structure.
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
Whereas
this is
you can't really
again.
take like half a chloroplast and still get photosynthesis out of it. You need the whole like integrated functional membrane structure and all of the photosystems, and like there's a minimum functional unit there that is still recognizable from its cyanobacterial origins.
Yeah, the cyanobacteria is great because it. I mean, of all the endosymbioses, it's the most straightforward for everyone to explain, because it's like, yeah. It looks like a algae, blue-green algae growing inside a cell, and its genome looks like a blue-green algal genome. Whereas the mitochondria are much more. So I guess back to one of your earlier points, well, my earlier points about how long it would have taken to go from that initial infection to being the last universal common ancestor. The last universal common ancestor only had six in its mitochondria, only had 67 structural genes, which means the mitochondria had lost nearly 2,000 genes. But what's super interesting is when you actually look at the genes the nucleus encodes, it got it from all sorts of places. It did not get it from the mitochondria. It just got it from all sorts of other bacteria, unknown sources, et cetera, et cetera. And this is, again, part of the model I'm working on at the moment is how to explain that.
Is there something about deep sea vents, assuming that's where the process happened, that make them a really good kind of, I guess you call it a genomic melting pot?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought about that. I think since they discovered the Asgard archaea, they've actually found they're much more widespread than just at the deep sea vents. So, but yeah, look, I don't know. It's a wise man who knows that he doesn't know the answer to that question.
Oh, I'm glad I got to throw an interesting question at you like that. Now there's another thing that's really interesting, and I think you had some theories about this. So we're assuming an archaeal like host cell.
Yeah.
It's been infected by either the virus or the proteobacteria, the ancestors of mitochondria. But presumably those ancestors of the mitochondria were quite prolific, and usually when symbiosis starts, it's fairly reversible. So there must have, I think you've written about this and you can elaborate, that's why I'm kind of prompting you, but there must have been some key process that allowed the virus to get the upper hand on those proto mitochondria. Because like if one of them mutated to become subservient or controlled by the proto nucleus, there'd be others that are unmutated. So
Yeah.
would that have been a really unlikely event?
Well, I think the enslavement of that bacteria, I've got some idle speculation about how it, so certainly today we know that the nucleus controls the mitochondria by having these various different proteins which it inserts into the mitochondrial membrane to allow it to transport proteins and everything. So somewhere that must have originated. And so it originated with that original enslavement act. But I expect that that is so rare, it's so hard to see how it happened, that this is probably one of the reasons that it took 2 billion years of life on Earth before we actually got the emergently complex eukaryotes starting to appear. So it's actually the enslavement. It's very difficult to come up with a mechanism because
You'd
it looks like
almost
it.
need an arrangement where there's only one of those proto mitochondria in the cell, so that
Yes,
if it mutates, there aren't unenslaved ones that can overwhelm it.
I think that's the case. Look at the argument goes like this. All eukaryotes today are known to have had a mitochondria in their past. That mitochondria is what they call monophyletic. There's no evidence that it comes from two different types of mitochondria. It's all descended from the same mitochondrial ancestor. So in terms of the evidence for it, it's more that it doesn't make sense for it to have enslaved multiple ones or for other ones to have served. It was a single event that caused that mitochondria to be enslaved. And on the evidence we've got today, it only happened once in 4 billion years.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I recall correctly, there was around the time that the eukaryotes emerged, there was an initial oxygen spike, but then it crashed before it came up again.
Yeah.
And it was during that crash period that seems to have been the origin point for eukaryote cells as we know them. So could that have been the trigger that the lower oxygen levels meant that symbiotic kind of a loose association was more likely to be pushed to only having like at most one of those proto mitochondria left in the cell, so you're more likely to have that mutation event put the reins in the hands of the
Yeah, it's
nucleus.
possible. It's possible. Look, the problem is that science progresses all the time, and there are papers coming about whether the eukaryotes arose during that oxygenation event or after that oxygenation event or before the oxygenation event. So it's not,
Take your
let's say it's not
pick.
settled science about when the eukaryotes arose relative. There's a couple of papers in the last 2 years which come out with opposite views. One is that yes, oxygenation was the key thing, and the other one comes out and says no, it wasn't oxygenation. So it's again, this is the thing about science when you are trying to live at the edge of where it's got to, is that it's not settled around. There's very few questions that are absolutely settled.
Yeah. I mean, there's another couple of recent observations of, I think there's even been a simple animal discovered that's lost its mitochondria.
Yeah, look, they
What
found
were those
that
little tiny, not many cell things in the mud near Vesuvius?
I'm not aware of that, but they have found recently, within the last 3 or 4 years, some eukaryotes that have no trace of a mitochondria actual organelle, but they certainly can see the traces in the genome. They're not saying that the so it's quite settled science, if you want to use those terms, that the mitochondria was present in the common ancestor of all eukaryotes.
And that it can they can be lost in rare cases, but at an expense of complexity. These are usually very simple organisms.
Look, yeast can lose its mitochondria relatively easily. The organism I work most of my day life on, you can destroy its mitochondria and it's fine because it can ferment. It can just take sugars and make alcohol. It doesn't actually need oxygen to live. Well, it still needs the iron sulfur genes, but it can have non-functional mitochondria except for the iron sulfur formation.
Now, I would love to spend a bit of time talking about like the reaction to your theory, because I think this is a really fascinating side of the story. Like, I'm basically sold on the story, on the theory. I think the people who are constantly throwing but ifs, but if, but what questions at it, the alternative theories like just don't have anything really. The evidence for them is even more of a just so story. Like you kind of have to stack up a whole bunch of explanations, whereas the viral approach kind of solves lots of problems at once. So I see it as both simpler and more supported by the data. But can
Yeah,
you
of
tell us
course.
a bit more about how the research community and the science journalism community has reacted to the theory?
Ah, it's a long story. I guess it comes in patches and it comes in ebbs and waves. Like, and it's kind of a challenge because really it's my responsibility to get out there and publicize this particular theory. Because, some famous scientist once said, the best way to hide something is in science is to publish the paper and then never talk about it in public, because that'll apparently just, get it out there. So, look, it's been resisted by a lot. I mean, if you accept my theory, you have to overturn basically every biological textbook you ever read. Everyone talks about a last universal common ancestor. Well, if my theory is right, that's not true. By definition, in textbooks, viruses are not alive. But if our nucleus is a virus, then, well, what is it? So it is a paradigm. You have to have a major paradigm shift. And I've introduced the idea that life shouldn't. So Darwin came out with this idea that all life descends from a common ancestor, which is great. It's a good idea. And he showed diagrams of trees and everything. And you know what? He was 100% correct for the organisms he looked at. He only looked at plants and trees and animals and doves and whatever he looked at.
I
And they
would
all
argue that
lived.
he missed. Well, he was dancing around hybrid speciation, but it never quite got into the boiled down version that
Yeah.
people took from his work.
But all of his work was predicated on eukaryotes. Every single organism he described, they're not really sure how much he was aware of the bacteria, let alone the viruses. So he was correct that all of the eukaryotes descend from a common ancestor, but other scientists have expanded on that idea and said all life comes from a single common ancestor. And viruses aren't alive, so that was by definition since the 1830s. So my theory requires a rethink about biology. And this is where I've come up with an idea that life actually should be defined as a yin-yang pair. In other words, there's viruses and cells, and they're of opposite, they define each other. You can't have a virus living without a cell. That's everyone accepts that. But when I look at evolution of prokaryotes, like bacteria and archaea, they actually can't live without viruses because you need lateral gene transfer to have evolution occur in these bacteria because of this. There's a thing called Muller's ratchet. So you can argue that those two are interdependent life forms. And that's what I'm arguing is that those two, they're not descended from a common ancestor, but you needed to always have both in life.
Could you argue that prokaryotes are temporarily denucleated eukaryotes? Like the temporary
I don't think so.
embarrassed billionaires kind of talk about
No,
Americans?
I think because I would have to argue because bacteria and archaea predate
I
like two
know.
billion years that
They
they
just
never
haven't
had
gotten
a
around
fossil.
to getting a nucleus yet. But it's still functionally there. It's just not always at home.
Yeah, that's right. Indeed, where they're a phage that build nuclei-like thing in bacteria. Yeah, so you could argue that.
Is there any evidence of, like, are there any circumstances where a eukaryotic cell ejects its nucleus?
The closest conceptually to that is, as far as I can it's a good question. I haven't got any answer to you, but the closest I've seen to that is red algae. So red algae actually have some of the nuclei, parasitic nuclei. So they're infectious nuclei. They actually get expelled and go and infect other normal red algae, and then produce more of the infectious nuclei. So
There you
it's
go.
like,
I
it's
knew it had to
like
be close to the protists. If there's going to be weird stuff
oh yeah,
going on, look to them.
well, the earlier you go in the phylogenetic tree of eukaryotes, the more flexibility they had. We can't go and change too much without just ending up dead. When you're a very simple eukaryote, you can go and change an awful lot of things and do very different things.
Are there any specialized denucleated cells in eukaryotes? I'm just
Yeah,
thinking like red blood
red blood
cells, how
cells.
they're formed.
Well, we have red blood cells which don't have nuclei.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm
Yeah,
grasping at
no. So
straws
the
here. But the infectious nuclei in red algae sounds like a great test system.
yeah, I'm no expert on them. I've read about them in, various literature things, but yeah, they're infectious nuclei from the algae.
But yeah, getting back to the response from
Oh yeah, back to the
academia,
response.
I
Yeah, look.
remember seeing this theory in science journalism in like the mid to late 2000s, and it kind of came with a bit of a bang. I saw it and latched onto it immediately, and I'm like, well, that makes perfect sense. And then it just kind of vanished.
Yeah, look. So yeah, look, I was lucky enough to back in the day when I first published it in 2000, I went to this thing called Fresh Science, which was supposed to be for, up and coming new young scientists. I was 40 at the time, so hardly fit the characteristic of a young scientist. But what they did was they actually, this was in Victoria, they got you to present the theory to the general public, which is as scary as you'd ever want to ever do, because it's quite a complicated theory. Presented it. But then they had media training and journalists interviewing, and that's why I got it into the Sydney Morning Herald. I got it into New Scientist, and then it just faded away because unless you could follow it up with other publications fairly quickly, your momentum can just fade. And then I lost a bit of interest in momentum when, there are crazy people out there. You get into the common newspaper and you will get people writing little notes to you about, oh, I don't like your theory. You should read the Bible more. And it's going, okay, I don't want anyone to know about who I am anymore.
Yeah, totally understandable. So that was like the journalism side. And I think it's maybe it had the disadvantage of being like a front-loaded theory. Like it was pretty much, whereas other stories that kind of build and then there's controversies and personality
Yeah.
clashes and stuff, like they get people thinking about it again. But yours was so neatly tied up. And so, I mean, if you knew a bit of biology, it was very easy to get your mind around it. But that was kind of like the end of the story. But what about academia? Because that's another side of things that I've been really interested
Well,
to get a sense of.
I'm not completely inert. I do get out there and I email various different people in various different laboratories who I think might be interested in my theory. But having got feedback from them, there are definitely people who really dislike my theory. And one of my pet peeves is that I was at a conference a couple of years ago and specifically talking to they'll remain nameless, but they are in particular labs in Europe somewhere. And I ran through the poster, the theory with them. And then they publish extensive reviews in Nature and forgot to mention that there's a theory about viruses. They were talking about the emerging consensuses about eukaryogenesis, and they just forgot that there's a theory, despite the fact that while he was writing it, we had the discussion. So it's quite. There are some people who really don't want to.
They're pointedly leaving it out of the conversation.
Yes. Look, and I don't want to go down the paranoid route. I'm not the, you know, there's no, you know, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist. It's just, you know, if you've built your entire career about your own theory and this is the model and this is whatever, then there's no, I don't see there's any incentive for them to accept.
Well, it's very difficult to pivot an academic career. Like
Yeah.
once you have a pet theory and, 100 publications out on it, it's very different to say, oh, I suddenly changed my mind and it's something completely different.
Yeah, no, the academics, I'm serious. I don't think we'll do that. It's not, it's in no one's benefit for them. And, you know,
Do you think you being outside of academia when you started, when you published this theory, might have, I don't know, cursed it? Like if an academic in an early career had started this theory and then made it their pet thing and kept writing incremental papers about it for decades, that might have been a pathway for it to become more widely accepted. Whereas you being a relative outsider, I mean, you're not completely an outsider, but I don't know. What are your thoughts on that theory?
My thoughts is that no, I'm not sure that's true because you know if I think of a counterexample, Albert Einstein, and not I'm not equating myself with him. He published his and you know fantastic year in 1904 or whatever it was when he was a patent clerk. So, and he got it out there, and I think those papers took the world by storm. So.
Do you think academia is like it was like 100 years ago, though, that the fundamental
That is a
structure
very
and
interesting
dynamics have
question.
changed?
That is a very interesting question because there's some objective evidence coming up that paradigms in biology are not changing at all. There's a metric that Nature, some people published in Nature the other week or a few months ago about how the big ideas are just not coming. But you know, one of the reasons for that is that so if I go, I can, you know, he says with bitter and twisted. Mind. I, you know, obviously submit my papers sometimes. The last ones, the one you read, the emergence, was asked to. I was asked to publish that one, so that was great. But the one before that, I sent it to Nature, and they just sent it back saying, this, it would not be of interest to our readers because it's not a field that is interesting. And I'm just thinking, you know, if you think I'm a crackpot, just write it, please. I'm keeping these letters. Just don't. Pretend it doesn't exist, and it's you know I try to keep it very much in the science. And look, I have to do that more than so than maybe some academics because as an outsider, I have to first of all when I submit papers go, you know they ask what academic institution do you work for, and I go none. I work for a company, so you know it's already you're already you've just got to make sure you're very rational in your arguments when you do it.
No, and I've read your papers and I appreciate how meticulous you are in putting things together. A really interesting parallel is Lin-Margulis, who is the person who championed the mitochondrial and then chloroplast endosymbiont theory through, I think, the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And like there's so many direct parallels between your story and her story, but she's
Far
been
wider.
cast as this kind of plucky early female scientist, going against the culture, refusing to shut up when people told her she was being ridiculous and her theories had no merit. And then over time, evidence accumulated, like more and more genetic and biochemical evidence accumulated that she was a correct. Though I will point out, I believe she also hypothesized that the flagella
Yeah.
was an endosymbiotic spirochete.
Yeah,
That
that's
ended
right.
up being a complete nonsense. So she wasn't 100% hitting the ball.
Well, let me say that in my theories, look, you know, I'm a big believer that all models are wrong, some models are useful. So like I'm hoping that if I am meticulous enough and I'm careful enough, but it's always very difficult to try and get out to the cutting edge. Without actually making some missteps. So I'll forgive her for thinking that the spirochetes. But I think she had the big advantage that she was actually married to Carl Sagan at the time. And he was very, very well connected for publications and everything. So in her instance, she published her seminal paper on the origin of mitosing cells in 1967. I've got textbooks sitting just behind me here, which are from 1970, and they already mentioned her by name. And you know, shout out to the endosymbiosis theory. So within 3 years of her publishing that paper, despite the fact she complains no one took it seriously. It was already in the textbooks. It's now 25 years, and I suspect mine won't be mentioned in any textbook anywhere.
And
But the other thing is that I'll just the bit of an anecdote, because I've been researching about, Margulis and the endosymbiotic theory. And, a guy called Ivan Wallen actually came up with the theory in 1922. And I downloaded his paper and read it and everything. It was very interesting. But he fell into disrepute because he claimed that he could try and grow mitochondria as bacteria. And that sort of threw shade on his theory. However, he was published in 1922, but in 1967, when Margulis published her paper, he died just 2 years before at age 86. And so it's like quite ironic that within if it's 5 another 2 years, it would all been, hey, it's in the textbooks, but he had to wait 60 years or 40 years or something for it to become accepted.
Interesting. Now I wanted to touch on, well, viruses are this kind of dark matter of biology and ecology. And we're now just starting to do like environmental surveys of viral diversity. And for every one small, simple pathogenic virus that we knew from like, tobacco plants, we're finding there's like 1,000 other odd viruses that we can scrape from the DNA or RNA in the environment, and we pretty much have no idea what they're doing. Do you suspect that like we're on the precipice of a completely different view of viruses?
Yeah, look, I hope so. I think for too long they've been ignored. They are considered superfluous to life, but you can find numerous examples where they're contributed so much to life. And if my theory was correct, then the nucleus is one of those examples. But that if you look, one of the amazing statistics is the 30% of the all the bacteria in the ocean die every day because they're infected by viruses, and they just, or phages in their case. But so that's, imagine if that's been going on for 4 billion years since life began. Every day in that 4 billion years, a third of the life forms in the oceans got killed by viruses. It just gives you an idea of the amount of churn and or potential for viruses to evolve.
Hey,
It's
casting a
incredible.
net further back, is it possible that bacteria and archaea themselves originated from a viral endosymbiont, that their circular chromosomes didn't necessarily evolve endogenously?
Yes, so you may have noticed by now I'm a little bit crazy. I'm actually just working on a paper on the origin of life, which I hope to get published over the next year or two. But basically, there is a guy called Patrick Forterra who proposed that the transition from the RNA world to the DNA world is actually viral mediated. So his idea is that you had the RNA world where, RNA is king, but what these viruses did was they invented DNA because it's stable and they can, it's basically methylated RNA and or oxygenated. My chemistry is not so good off the top of my head. But the yeah, his argument is that each of the three domains is derived from a viral input, so that the invention of DNA itself in that transition was a viral invention. He got a reasonable bit of traction with that.
Interesting. I also have a kind of more speculative question. Do you suspect that there might be some viral life out there that isn't dependent on cellular life to complete its life cycle, and that we just haven't fished it out from the millions of sequences?
No, I believe that. See, yeah, no. The only yeah, the viruses don't. One of the defining features of viruses, so far, until they find one that is a counterexample, is that they don't have ribosomal apparatus. So they can't make proteins on their own. They have to get into a cell that has the protein apparatus there. So at this stage, and I'm not sure you'd call it a virus if it actually had its ribosomal apparatus. Our eukaryote nucleus has that, but that's it. Our nucleus is no longer a virus. It has been a very, very long time since it was a virus.
That's all right. I appreciate you entertaining my wild questions. And there's an even wilder one I have. Is it possible that there's an entirely different domain of life on Earth that isn't dependent on DNA and that our sequencing just misses? Like there's even amongst the bacteria, there are so many that cannot be cultured that we've only just realized are there. And this all this other diversity we've picked up through DNA screening of the environment. But if there was a completely different kind of biochemistry, would it be invisible to us at this stage?
Well, if it wasn't DNA based, yes, it would be invisible to us. But if it is DNA based, and it functions using ribosomes, like so you're if, it depends where you what level you're thinking at. If you're thinking, is there a third domain? So bacteria, archaea, and domain X. If they descend from a common ancestor, which looks like the translational apparatus does for all bacteria and archaea, then you would expect there'd be homology. And I know I haven't seen any papers published on it because you probably can't get it published, but certainly I know of people who've thought, you know what, I can design some consensus ones that would pick up things that were intermediate between bacteria and archaea or more obscure out in other directions. And as far as I know, no one's come up with anything yet.
Yeah, I guess I'm just a little bit intrigued by the I was at UQ when the nanobacteria
Oh yeah.
thing kind of blew up and then blew up in people's faces. And but I mean, there was
Anodes.
maybe it was complete nonsense, or maybe there was something going on, but it ran out of momentum. Like it's
Yeah, look, I've tried to track down that literature, whether it's still there's nothing, I can't find much about it. Yeah, look, it's possible, but I suspect that there are probably just the two domains on Earth, but the thing would be to do is go out there and work out a different method to identify the life form. So a lot of the ways they do it nowadays is, you can do fish or in situ hybridization using the probes, and I think they find all the things that are bacterial or prokaryotic like have either bacteria or archaeal ribosomes. So I'm not sure there's, I think it's a very interesting question.
I mean, it relates to exobiology too. If we do get to dig around on other planets, what exactly we're looking for.
Ah, yes,
If
well.
it's very different, it's going to be a very weird chicken and egg kind of problem.
Well, yeah, no, but if my paper gets published, and it'll take me another couple a year, well, a while to get it done, I would argue that life in our solar system will all be descended from a common ancestry. So it should be readily detectable. But I would argue that life should be super abundant in our solar system, but we just haven't looked for it properly yet because we can't get to those other planets.
I wouldn't even be surprised, given what we know about the deep biosphere on Earth, that pretty much any rocky planet that isn't completely cooked from the surface down, like the moon, for example, probably has a Goldilocks zone somewhere in its mantle. Where the temperatures and pressures, there's going to be some life forms that are on Earth that would be capable of hanging on there and, like, dividing their little tiny cells once every 1,000 years.
I feel that's true because a lot of the life on Earth, there is a lot of evidence, they go down 3, 4 kilometers deep for some of the deep mines in South Africa, and you can find bacteria growing in the rocks. You can actually find eukaryotes growing in the rocks. Yeast, there's yeast down there as well,
Oh, wow.
I believe. But yeah, they're it is definitely a habitat. The mantle up to a certain temperature, or the crust at certain temperatures, is definitely a habitat for bacteria.
I saw a really interesting bioinformatic argument that if you look at the complexity of genomes over time on Earth and project them back to like the simplest possible bringing together of nucleotides, that it roughly lines up with the age of the universe, according to Big Bang theory, and that it's possible that during the very early Big Bang, there was a period that the whole universe was in a Goldilocks state, that might have been where those original biochemicals had an opportunity to start going through that early chemical evolution, and it wasn't a warm pond, as I think it was
Yeah,
Darwin
well, I mean,
proposed.
look, one of the, I mean, I guess one of the problems with that particular argument would be that, as far as I understand it, when the Big Bang occurred, only hydrogen helium and lithium were actually produced, and you actually had to have stars form to do the nuclear synthesis to get things like carbon and water and oxygen and those
I
other
believe
elements.
the James Webb data is showing that black holes and like early elemental cycling started much sooner than they originally predicted.
Oh, okay.
So
Look, that's
maybe.
again, it's these this is where you can't be a big enough polymath to follow all
Oh
of
yeah.
the scientific
And it's still very
progress.
speculative, but it's just kind of hopeful that if biomolecules and partially evolved biomolecules are everywhere, then there could be recognizable life forms pretty much
Look,
everywhere.
in this, to stop, pushing my own barrow, I don't want to do that. But if I can get this paper published, one of its predictions is that life will be super abundant in the entire universe. One of the conclusions would be that, the solar systems weren't didn't create life. It was life created the solar systems. But I won't go on
Oh.
and tell you how mad I am until we're offline on that particular one.
I'll have
Because
to follow
there's
up on that.
credibility and there's a lack of credibility, so I'll keep
Now,
mum on
there's a question I always love asking people at the end, and especially for you. It's normally for plant breeders, but if you could create any organism, what would you kind of will into existence? Like no limits on resources and time, just that it's relatively biophysically plausible.
Look. I'm sorry, but I'm a bit of a fan of Jurassic Park, and I think it'd be very, very fun. But I'm not going to do it. The construction of those sorts of life forms,
You
so
know, with Jurassic Park, those dinosaurs would probably be lying around with oxygen masks like Christopher Skase. They would be they wouldn't be chasing anyone.
Well, maybe, but I know that maybe I thought it was more the carbon dioxide. But anyway, yeah. Look. Look, there are many things going forward which you could life could have taken so many different routes, and the what I'm very interested in is what is the phenotype space that life is capable of doing? Like we at the moment are probably the most intelligent species we've encountered, and all the sci-fi movies always show that big, strong, tough monsters are always dumb, and the small and small wimpy ones are always intelligent, but it'd be quite fun to think about ones where the big tough ones are as 10 times more intelligent than everything else. So, there are a lot of there's and I think with AI we may actually be able to do some of this kind of design of genomes to create new organisms. Because if you think about it, if we've got hundreds of genome sequences, if you fed them in as a deep language model into as a basically a deep language model, you might be able to work out for it to design a particular genome that would give you whatever you asked for. Because we've got bees and we've got mice and we've got humans and we've got plants and animals and all sorts of things that have, they've got genomes for, and we also know what they look like. So yeah, anyway, that's for the future.
Do you ever think about like two strains of prokaryote protists, with complex nuclei, properly committed to being multicellular? We got the animals, we got the plants, the fungi kind of dabble with it, and there's a few other organisms that kind of they become a bit multicellular when they're in the mood. But do you suspect that there's potential for other protists to be kind of cradled through that process into full multicellularity, that there could be whole new kingdoms of multicellular life waiting for humans to kind of help them along?
On our Earth, no. I would argue that they lost their opportunity to expand into that niche when the plants and the animals and the fungi took that niche.
Yeah, but that's why maybe humans could actually protect them from that competition through the early phases.
Yeah, it's possible, but under the current wild type Earth, I suspect they'd have to expand in the niche where there's already a highly efficient
Yeah, exactly.
multicellular organism, and that's going to be very difficult, in my opinion. And that's an opinion, not fact.
Well, that's a very, I mean, we're at such an interesting stage in scientific history that all of these tools and all of this information that were unimaginable not that long ago are like falling into our hands. Almost, I would argue, too much information in some ways, that the It's much easier for a research group to just sequence another genome than can actually than to actually sit down and figure out what all of the data we have means.
Yeah, look, I mean, one of my colleagues used to say, like, he's 5 or 6 years older than I, that back in his day, it was one gene, one function, one paper. Now you'd have to do, like, multiple comparative genomes to get sort of a paper published. So yeah, look, I mean, the swamping of information, but it's picking out the bits that are interesting. It's the, because we're going to be swamped with data. It's how does that impact on your understanding of life? Because that's, I study biology because, I like to know, see, and I'm very interested in evolution because I want to know why I am what I am and how things go. And the swamping of that data doesn't really contribute that much in my mind. Like there's a lot of papers that come out in Nature that you read and you go, yeah, that's just filling in one jigsaw piece. Protein X, of course, is going to interact with another protein. You've just identified it. So a lot of the data is just swamping. It's data swamp rather than picking up on a meaningful progress in understanding life. For
Do you
some of them.
think we might be at the end of journals and papers as being the mechanism for communicating scientific information?
Well, in my own personal opinion, I think there are a number of threats to the integrity of the system right at the moment. So, because I've published a few papers over the last 5 years, I get 20 emails a day from people going, hey, do you want to publish in our journal? Just pay me $500 and you can publish. And can you do this and you do that? So there's one threat. The second threat is the that there's a lot of places that have incentivized just publishing papers, whether it's just completely fabricated and without a very good peer review system. The peer review system relies on trust. Trust that you actually did those experiments. So I see a lot of threats to the current peer reviewed. Certainly,
The idea that we're just going to feed all of the research papers from history into AI and it's suddenly going to be a genius. I'm like,
no.
which 50% of the papers are you going to feed it? The ones that aren't suspect?
Yeah, but also as somebody who is attempting to overthrow the entire biological paradigm. I imagine that AI is very good at reinforcing the existing paradigm because it will just go through what everyone already agrees today and just summarize what it is effectively. It won't create a, oh, all of those papers are wrong. This is the way you really what really happened. I don't see how it creates that. I mean, for me, artificial intelligence is an interesting one because I think if you have a dog, a human, and an AI computer, you can see they're all very different to each other. But a human, no, sorry, a dog, my dog's very intelligent. It can tell when I want to take it for a walk. It's emotionally, but it will never speak a word in the light. It's life. It will never tell me the formula for water or anything like that. So it doesn't meet intelligence in that game. AI will be able to tell you everything you want ever to hear, but the only one that actually combines both types of intelligence is us, as humans. And I'm not sure AI is really gonna solve that particular problem because it just sound, to me it just sounds intelligent because it's read everything we've ever written.
Yeah. Oh, it's a whole other bu bucket of worms, so we'll try not to step into that one. But let's wrap things up. If people want to learn more about what you do, could you recommend a couple of papers maybe that are publicly accessible? Or newspaper articles for people who don't want to dive into a full research. And I can look them up and put the links in the show notes so people
Okay, well,
can read more
I
about
can
your
think about that. I
work.
mean, there,
Yeah.
I've actually, got a very kind wife who's allowed me to. When I publish my papers, I actually pay extra, an extra $5,000 or whatever, so that they're publicly accessible. So all of my viral eukaryogenesis, or the most recent ones, are all free to, and I can send you through some links to both of those papers, but.
Brilliant.
And I've written a few book chapters. I think some of them are free, but yeah.
I highly recommend people to follow it up because it's a great example of a paradigm shift that's taking place right now, and
Yeah.
not many people
Someday.
are paying attention to it.
Yeah. Look, I'm hoping that it will eventually get there. And, look, if it'd be easy for me to blame everyone else if it doesn't get out there. But as I said, Francis Darwin said, credit goes to the ones who convinces everyone. And so what I'm, one of the reasons I'm doing this is to try and get out there and convince people that theory is valid. And I want to hear the criticisms of it. I'm very interested in hearing criticisms of my theory.
Well, with that, thank you very much, Philip, for a fascinating talk. And yeah, thank you very much for sharing some of your time with me.
Okay, no, thank you, Shane. Enjoyed it.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me. Or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.